there, dear listeners, and welcome to this episode of For Real. I'm your host, Kim Stewart, and I just want you to know that my guest today knows a lot about something we are facing more and more. Therefore, I hounded her and her team for 2 years to get her on the show. They were all very kind and long-suffering with my hounding, and they didn't even block my emails. I'm so happy to report that Sissy Goff is on For Real today. Sissy is a superhero to the mental health world, and she is a superhero to me. If you or anyone you love is dealing with anxiety, particularly in kids and teens, please stop what you're doing and get a pen and paper because this one is a note taker. Without any more waiting, I am thrilled to let you eavesdrop on my conversation with therapist, speaker, author, and just a wonderful human being, Sissy Goff. Sissy Goff, I am beyond thrilled to have you here on For Real. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, we've been on for 2 minutes getting ourselves ready, and you've already made me laugh about 40 times. So I feel so excited about this conversation.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I did say I feel like I'm meeting Taylor Swift even better. I'm sure Taylor's a lovely person.
Oh.
But I don't know if you know this, but I started asking your wonderful team if you had just a little minute long ago, and they were so gracious and so kind. And I know you have a ton going on. So I want you to know I have been pursuing you, Sissy. And so thank you for taking the time to do this because I really need to learn from you. You have written this beautiful, so many beautiful books, but the two that I'm thinking about today are books about helping our people with anxiety, specifically. Raising Worry-Free Girls is the parent-directed book that I just devoured. And then you have a kind of compendium, which is called Brave, A Teen Girl's Guide to Beating Worry and Anxiety. And so I am not even small talking. I am not even going there because I feel the weight of this as a mom among moms. So I'm grateful that in my own family, we just have so many friends and friends of friends of, and my best friends are all dealing with this in their homes, particularly with their teenagers. Yes. And so you do beautiful work in the Nashville area. Talk to me just a little bit about what you do there and about Daystar and how you came to be Sissy Goff, who, by the way, listeners, is not related to Bob Goff. I mean, she is. You are. But not the Bob Goff I know.
Right. Right. It's a little confusing. Yes. So I have been counseling girls and families since 1993, which is a lot of years, makes me feel really old. And I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas originally, and I moved to Nashville to go to grad school at Vanderbilt and literally did my internship at Daystar. So I've been there ever since. And it is this magical little yellow house that's not quite so little anymore, but the yellow house where we see kids from about second through 12th grade. I think we have 13 humans on staff. We have 5 dogs, which are many of the kids who come. It's their favorite therapist. And we do individual counseling and group counseling. And then I do a lot of what are called parent consults that are just kind of, is everything normal? What do we need to be doing differently? Do we need to be in counseling? You know, questions like that. And so out of that work, I have gotten to write and speak and travel and have a podcast of my own with 2 of my dear friends and coworkers. And so that's kind of the story. And I just feel very privileged to get to do what I do every day.
Well, listen, I have many times when talking with friends and just in our own family life, I've thought, how can I get to the little yellow house? So since we all can't come to the little yellow house, I'm so grateful that you've written these books to help come alongside families, particularly in this area of anxiety. I'm wondering if we can start with hope, which seems like maybe flip into the back of the book. But there is hope, you say. You tell us that even though anxiety is so common and so can be so debilitating. It's also very treatable.
Yes.
So I want to start there. So for all of our listeners who are in the trenches, this is something that we can enter into, right? And it's not the end.
Right.
The period isn't at the end of the sentence.
Yes, that's a great way to say it. And really exactly why I wrote the books. Anxiety is the most common, I mean, it's referred to as a disorder. I don't even like to call it that. I mean, I would say most common struggle that kids and adults are dealing with today, which we might have to talk about my next book at some point along the way because it pertains, but it's the most common issue, but it is also the most treatable. You're exactly right. And the kind of the front runner in ways to treat anxiety is cognitive behavioral therapy, which those books are loaded with, as is there's a book for elementary age girls called Braver, Stronger, Smarter. And so my intention writing Raising Worry-Free Girls and Braver, Stronger, Smarter, it was really before the pandemic started. But I was seeing anxious girls in droves in my office. And so I decided to write these two books. Then the pandemic hit and I immediately was most worried about the teenage girls. And so, we didn't have a lot to do during that season. So I wrote another book. I think in 6 weeks it took me to write that book. And so I cranked out Brave. Well, we weren't doing anything. We were just sitting at home. I bought a golf cart for my 40th birthday present to myself, and I drive to my sister's house at night and write and counsel all day. So
amazing. Well, you made better use of that time than I did. I think I ate bread and chocolate in copious amounts.
Well, I did that too. Yes.
But talk to me about that, Sissy. You mentioned that this is such a prevalent issue. It feels like there's a gigantic uptick in anxiety in both adult friends and teenage friends. And I'm wondering, was I just not paying attention in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up? Or is there really an increase?
There is definitely an increase. Absolutely. I think among both. And we can talk about the reasons for kids and parents. But part of, I think, what's happening is there were quite a few of us were anxious too, but we weren't talking about it. We weren't talking about emotions. We were not passing feelings charts around the dinner table, which I would highly recommend, you know, and so I think we went underground with it, or I'm a one on the Enneagram. I think every perfectionist who's a one has some degree of anxiety. We just got really productive rather than feeling it. Same. Yeah. So I think we didn't know to be able to be aware that we had it. And our parents certainly didn't know. So there's been this trickle down effect.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking of my grandparents and how they would say, well, she's a worrier. And that was kind of a catch-all. But I don't remember kids not going to school because they were worried, or kids not being able to engage in their lives. And I feel like I hear those stories more and more. And I'm wondering
more than ever.
Part of it. Yes. So I wonder if before we even move too far in, if we can define terms, because a lot of times you write about this, and I completely wholeheartedly agree that the word anxious or the words panic attack have kind of moved into our vernacular, maybe not always accurately. So the overuse of those words sometimes dilutes what's actually happening. So please define anxiety for us. I know you talk about the single loop roller coaster. You have these beautiful visuals to really help us grab onto this. And I'm wondering what your working definition is, because I think some folks listening will think, well, I don't know that my teenager is dealing with anxiety. I think it's more that she just has a personality that tends to worry.
Yes.
So how do we know? How do you define?
Yes. I mean, I think honestly, post-pandemic, I think everybody has a personality that tends to worry. I mean, I just think that's part of how it's impacted all of us. But the reason I attach to that one loop roller coaster is all of us have intrusive thoughts every day. For those of us who tend towards worry, we worry about them a little bit more. But when we're anxious, they get stuck. And we can't stop thinking about it. And we could do an outline for you of different ages, and could track even what kids are afraid of most commonly at different ages, because it's basically the scariest thing they can imagine at that age, which for little ones, that's why it's being away from mom or dad, or even something bad happening to mom or dad when I'm away from them. And they get a little bit older. And I don't know how many kids dozens I have counseled at this point that it becomes about something like throwing up. They go to a birthday party and someone throws up, and now every time their tummy feels the least bit weird, they think, oh no, I'm going to throw up. I'm going to throw up, to the point that their stomach gets upset. And then they end up throwing up, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And which is why parents in my office will say so often, I never worried until I had kids. Because all of a sudden, the scariest thing you can imagine happening matters more than it's ever mattered, because you love these little people like crazy. And so the same thoughts can loop. So, but you said it. I mean, anxiety now is keeping us from doing things. It's become very limiting for kids and sometimes for adults. And so I have done at this point, because now I've written my fourth book, I think, about anxiety. So I bet I've read 35 books about anxiety. And in that research, the definition I came up with is that anxiety is an overestimation of the problem and an underestimation of ourselves. Now, that's not clinical anxiety. There's a clinical anxiety that starts to happen when the chemistry of our brain is shifting. And that's what we need a counselor to help us work through and define more. But I'm just talking about every day I live with this sense of impending doom, or this critical voice I can't get out of my head that's telling me all my failures, or my children are, in either case. Mm-hmm.
That is a beautiful definition. Say it one more time. An overestimation
of the problem and an underestimation of themselves.
Okay. So here is my follow-up to that. You write a lot about parents. This was a surprise to me, yes. Sissy. I thought this was a child issue. I thought this was their problem. And turns out you do a beautiful job of kind of collating all of that research you mentioned and saying the most important agents of change in fighting that monster of anxiety is actually the parent. You talk about genetics and parenting style and modeling, all of these things that contribute to how anxiety plays out or does not play out in our homes. I love, there's just one moment where you say, other than showing your child love and affection, managing our own stress is the best thing we can do to be an effective and empowering parent. And I just did not expect that. On the one hand, you're very good about saying that you're not blaming the parent for the child's anxiety or for the teenager's anxiety. No. But what we do, you know, we are living in a space together. So talk to me about how the parent, how her or his role really affects this condition or this moment in a family.
Yes. I mean, there are several ways, which is why I kind of came up with those different categories in the book. But I mean, genetically speaking, if you have done a lot of work yourself, but you are anxious growing up, or you still are fighting it, but lean that way, they're 7 times more likely to deal with it themselves. And so that's part of I want to say there is no blame in this, and it, you know, can be like inheriting blonde hair. I mean, it's going to be a part of some kids' makeup. And today, because I think exactly what we were talking about before, a lot of us weren't talking about our emotions. No one understood us when we were growing up. I'm seeing parents more than ever before overcompensate for what they missed. And in that overcompensating, well, I'll give you an example. So as I said, Daystar's this cute yellow house. We have a white picket fence. Our offices look like living rooms. If I have a child come in to see me for counseling, I know already just the house is going to make them feel more comfortable. And so I had this little girl who was coming in to see me, and I could tell on the computer application that we use that she was coming in for anxiety. She was 8. The average age of onset used to be 8. Now we're seeing it drop to 6 with signs as young as 4 and 5. And so this little girl was there to see me, and I came down the stairs of the house because my office is upstairs, and you can tell I have a really enormous smile. And I saw this little girl sitting across from me, and I waved at her really big, and she waved back at me. And I walked over and I said, I'm Sissy. I'm so excited you're at Daystar. I'm going to take you on a tour of the house, and then we're going to go up to my office, and we're going to meet my little dog named Lucy, who is going to love you. And this precious little girl popped up to follow me, and her mom grabbed her arm and said, do you feel comfortable with that? She's paying for her to come to counseling with me. I mean, you know, I understand the fear of a child being behind a closed door with an adult you've never met. And if we're thinking about it that way, counseling could be terrifying. And we've got to work through our own stuff to live with some degree of trust, you know, that enables us to do the work and them to do the work they need to do. So I think that's a picture of that overcompensating. And so I think we We offer a lot of empathy. We want to sit with them in that because no one did that with us, which is so important. But we've got to help them work through it. And every person in the helping profession who works with anybody with anxiety would say they've got to work through it.
You talk about this in the book that parents are get to be masters of, and teenagers do too, children do too, escape and avoidance, that we just want it to be better. And I have dear friends walking through this right now. And let me just tell you, by midnight, nobody has anything left to offer. And so, right. You know, you're talking about that story about the mom kind of interrupting is kind of a beginner's version, I guess, of rescuing, right? And helping her avoid the thing. And you write about how doing the scary thing is actually the thing. That when we try to circumvent and protect and do herding motions around, that's actually not helping. It's not the way to go. So talk to me about both of those things, the exhaustion of parents and also that kind of knee jerk of trying to escape or avoid, and actually that those aren't the things to help.
Yes. I love that you said that because that is profoundly true that parents are exhausted. And I, in fact, would say in the last 6 months, I have never seen as many weary and defeated parents as I've seen that just feel like failures, because I think it feels like they're facing this uphill battle and nothing's moving the needle. Nothing's making it better. And it feels exhausting. And that's the thing about anxiety too, is that anxiety left untreated only gets worse. And so if you really are doing it alone with no tools, it's getting worse. And you're not crazy to feel that way. And again, there are practical things you could do today that could start to make a difference with your kids, boys and girls. And one of those is, to your point, escape and avoidance. Those are the most two common strategies in light of anxiety. And when we do that, we're just emphasizing the definition we talked about earlier. You're right. It is too big. You're too small. You can't do it. And so I've got to step in and rescue you in this moment, which is never the intended message. That's not what any parent would ever try to say to their kids, but that's the message the kids get. And the hard thing is, the more that kids do the scary thing, the more confidence they derive from it. But the less they do it, the less likely they're going to be to do it. So anxious kids get really manipulative and really loud and really emotional. And so then it's just that much harder to push them when you really are trying to do that. And so we've got to be careful not to fall for that, to be this force of compassion and growth that we're offering both for them, that we're helping with a lot of kindness, a lot of empathy. We're helping them move forward.
Okay. Before I do one more question, I have to ask this because I appreciate you talking even just in that moment about the weariness. I got three separate messages in the last 3 hours from people who didn't even know I was talking to you, like friends and adjacent friends who said, I'm so exhausted and feel like I've done everything wrong as a parent. That's unsolicited. Folks are saying this and they didn't even know I was talking to you today. And so I agree. I feel like there's just this cloak of weariness. And part of it, I wonder, I'm pretty sure, is just that isolation in parenting. You feel like there's no way anybody else is going through this. And when you couple that with a teenager who's going through this, you can't stuff them in a car seat and say, you have to go to therapy. So can you talk to me about that? How do we help kids who are too old to be incentivized with a trip for ice cream? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is a different phase in parenting for a lot of us. How do you counsel parents who want to help, but the help is refused?
Yes, that's a great question. And before I answer it, I want to say one more thing to the weary parents.
Yes,
that
please.
I found. So my newest research, my newest book is for parents themselves about their own anxiety.
Please,
it's called
Jesus
The Worry-Free Parent.
Is it out?
You're so funny. I think you can pre-order it right now.
Okay, pre-order.
But I'm going to do some fun things with pre-orders in the month leading up to it. So honestly, I would say don't pre-order it.
Okay.
Yes, don't pre-order. It'll be available in August. So in July, hop on Amazon and pre-order it. And it's for the reason that we're talking about. that I wrote the book. I just have been so worried about parents. And in my research for that, one of the things that I came across that I had heard before, but I'd forgotten, was that actually two different people or two different theories that I really like. Dan Allender, who's one of my favorite psychologists on the planet, he says the same thing that attachment parenting theories say, which is good parents get it right 50% of the time.
Yeah, that's about it.
50%. And you're considered a good parent. That's no, what your kidding. Job needs. And
so, right.
If that makes you breathe a little deeper as you're listening, you know, that's sure my hope because I think that's part of the problem. Why things are worse is because the bar now is ridiculous in terms of what's been set. And it wasn't for our parents. They didn't feel like they were supposed to do all the things and be in all the places and have all the right answers and listen and get your kid. You know, there's just a million things that feel like they're weighing on parents now.
Oh, that is so 50%. Helpful. 50%. I remember when my kids were in kindergarten, their teacher said to me something like that. I'll believe 50% of what she says to me about you. And you did the same for me. Right.
Oh,
and just like that,
I love
blanket
that.
Of grace. We all know we're just fumbling in the dark, but you are right. The language that this one friend texted to me this morning was, and this person has a very large family and a lot of things going on. And they said, I just wonder if any of the decisions we've made were right. So, you know, that ache. And then trying to figure out, well, how to help. And one of this person's children also is just dealing with crippling anxiety. So talk to me about that family and so many families where the teenager doesn't want to go in. They don't want to find a therapist. And a lot of the language that he or she uses is, I don't trust them. Why would I trust that process, right? So how do we step away from that ledge? And what do we do as parents?
So my favorite example, I mean, we obviously have a lot of kids who come in that don't want to come in for counseling. And that's so much of why we're in Yellow House and we have dogs and we have popcorn after school in our kitchen. And I wish there was a Daystar in every part of the country, and there's not.
Me too. Yeah.
But I would say to parents, go in and meet the person first, because if you get your child there, you want to have a sense that there's going to be a connection. And I think warmth is one of the most important things when it comes to counselors for kids. And so going in and having a sense of that person is really important. But my favorite way I've ever heard it explained, I had a mom who came in to my office about a year ago, and she said, my daughter said, are you kidding me? You're going to make me go talk to somebody that I've never met. Why would I tell that person? And she said, honey, my job as your parent is to build your team. I have people on your medical team that are your doctors that are watching over your body, that are helping me make the right decisions. I have people on your academic team that are helping me with your cognitive development and your brain growing and challenging you. Of course, I would have someone on your emotional team. And that's what this is. And so this is just going to be a part of our life, not always, but in seasons. It's going to be in seasons for you, and it's going to be in seasons for me. And they're going to help you work through things, and they're going to help me figure out how I can be the best mom or dad to you that I can be. And I love that idea of building your team.
Oh, it's so good. And it's so good for the mom or dad to hear. They need the team. We cannot do this on our own.
They need the team.
Yes. No, in fact, I am wondering about what you'd say to that. If there's a parent listening and their child is just exhausting them, right? I mean, and you write about how anxiety, that it doesn't get better as it goes without help, and that it starts to spill over into everybody in the home, right? So then we've got a whole bunch of different things going on. Does that parent need to go for counseling? Like, let's say that the teen is not into it. I know you just said we should go meet the prospective counselors, but is there value in the parent going alone or the parents together going alone if the anxiety is really top?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And especially if your child won't go, then I would highly recommend you to go, because there are things you could do even in sneaky ways that your kids might not know what you're doing that can help them. And most therapists who work with kids, and this is something else I would ask for, but like our policy is every third appointment, we spend half the time with the parents. So we're giving regular feedback. And then, you know, hopefully I become a trusted voice with the parent too. And I can say to them, it might be great for you to have your own support. you know, so I think as you're finding a therapist for your kids, if you can get your kids to go, find one that will work with you as well. Because we see plenty of parents who've been somewhere else and said, I could never get their counselor to tell me anything, which obviously you want the counselor to respect confidentiality, but there are ways they can help you without breaking the child's confidentiality.
Okay, fantastic. Talk to me about the family that doesn't know yet. So maybe there's some signs that their child might be dealing with some anxiety. That's one of the most fascinating things in your books. I just was eating that up in terms of, first of all, how anxiety presents differently in boys and girls. And that some of the things that we slot under, oh, she's a perfectionist, or, oh, you know, she just really cares very deeply, that girls and boys do this differently and they present differently. So just a quick primer, if you would, just for families watching their own children, how do we know if anxiety even is a thing?
Yes. So, and the little girl's book I called Braver, Stronger, Smarter. And part of that's because I love the quote by Pooh, but also because, I mean, I've seen thousands of kids now dealing with anxiety, and literally 100% of them, which I would rarely say 100% of anything at this age, but 100% of them are really bright and they're really conscientious and they care so deeply and they're trying hard. I mean, they're the coolest kinds of kids, and they just can't turn the volume knob down on that. And so I think that's a conversation we want to have. But even out of that great care and conscientiousness, I talk about this continuum from exploders to imploders. And if David Thomas, who's the boy version of what I do, if he were sitting here, he would say, often boys lean toward being the exploders. Now, I would say there are a lot of little girls who lean towards being explosive too. And their parents come in, not because they think they're anxious, but because they think they're having behavior problems.
Right.
And they're using words like controlling and angry and demanding. And it's because, you know, it's something like she thought she was going to get to go right home after school. And you say, oh no, we've got to run three errands and then we'll get home, but it'll probably be about 2 hours after you thought. And she just totally loses it.
Right.
And so as I sit with those parents, I always say, tell me the times you're seeing it. What are the themes? And it's often transitions and unpredictability. And, you know, I don't know about you, but if someone told me at 3 p.m, my day was going to look totally different than I thought, and I had no control, I would feel anxious. And they don't yet have the words to say, when you change my schedule at the last minute, it makes me feel worried.
Right.
So it just comes out as anger. And so we want to really watch for that. And on the other end are the imploders. And I think for those kids, they are the ones who are the perfectionists. They're the ones that you go to the parent-teacher conference and the teacher says, I wish every child in my class acted like yours, because they're doing everything they can to fly under the radar, do it all right. But it's fueled more by anxiety than it is just a sense of who they are. They're conscientious, but it ripples over into more anxiety. And I think post-pandemic, more than ever, I'm seeing that as an issue. And that's part of why girls are twice as likely to deal with anxiety, but boys are taken in for treatment more, because a lot of anxious girls are delightful. And I mean, some of those parents say, well, she does explode sometimes at home, but I think out in public, they're delightful.
Right. Checking all the boxes, super conscientious, involved in all the things. And
yes.
Yeah, overcommitted. So talk to me about when I'm thinking exploding in the exploding moments. Tell me, Sissy, tell us what, just give parents something to hold on to here, because that the tension ratchets up really quickly. You write in the book about how, you know, teenagers in particular, well, I guess everybody, when you're in fight or flight, your frontal lobe is not working. And so logic goes out the window. Nobody can be talked down from those particular moments, right? You can't say, oh, this is really overreacting about the change in your schedule, right? That helps no one. But a lot of times, particularly the older these kids get, they have weapons of choice with their mouths too. And so, you know, you can get very distracted in the moment by the hysteria coming out. So let's say a parent listening has this happen this week where they know that this is anxiety driven. Maybe the child doesn't know. What can he or she do? What can the mom or dad do in the moment And then in subsequent moments, when they're off the mountain, how can we help our kids through that? And how can we do it in a way that leans towards peace in the family? Because so many of my friends going through this, these aren't only children, the siblings are in the room too. And so again, that spillover effect, how do we help these families? How do we help our kids in those moments?
Well, can I give you my top three things?
Please. So these are you kidding me?
First yes. three tools. These are the first three things I would yes. do in counseling in my office. So you nailed it. When they have hit that fight or flight mode, which kids do so quickly, especially when they've been doing it, because the part of the brain that's taking over in those moments is the amygdala. And the amygdala, the more often it takes over, the more likely it is to take over. It becomes what's considered hyper-responsive. It actually enlarges in the brain. And so kids get to where they go to 60 like that. And so we've got to calm their bodies down before we can do anything else. And I want to address this with little ones and adolescents, because I think it's trickier with adolescents in some ways. But with younger ones, I think the first thing we want to do is calm ourselves down, get quiet rather than louder, get down on their level and say, let's take three deep breaths together. And the way I do it is called square breathing. David calls it combat breathing with boys because he learned it from the Navy SEALs and it sounds cooler for guys to jump on board with. But basically, each line of your square, you breathe in for 4 seconds, you pause in the corner, out for 4 seconds, pause in the corner, in for 4 seconds, pause in the corner, and keep doing that square. And 20 seconds of deep breathing begins to reset the amygdala. So that's where I always want to start with kids. Now, there are some kids who are already way too activated, or I think often with boys in general, they're going to say, I don't want to breathe. And so with those kids, movement. I want you to go run up and down the stairs three times, or I want you to go run three laps around the house, something like that, where they're getting some release in their body, and then they can come back and you can use the other tools. But we've got to start with breathing or movement, because we've got to shift the blood flow back to the prefrontal cortex that helps them think rationally and manage their emotions. That is, at this point, just as you said, getting zero blood. There's nothing happening in that part of their brain. It's gone offline. So we've got to get it moving again.
Okay, what if there's pushback? I mean, you said boys might say, I'm not breathing. One thing I'm not doing right now is breathing. So what happens if there's pushback in that suggestion?
Well, there's a lot of pushback. And kids will say it doesn't work because they try it once. Or we say, I want you to take deep breaths. And they go, it's not helping me. You know. So what I've been doing in my office, especially on this side of the pandemic, is I'm having parents reward kids for any positive coping strategy and calling them brave beads or brave pom-poms or whatever it is like that with younger ones. Okay, this is a great opportunity to earn a brave bead. Let's take three deep breaths together. Or you can get a brave bead. I know you've been wanting extra reward if you go run a lap around the house. And ahead of time, you come up with what they can trade the beads in for.
Okay.
Together with them. So they're giving some input. So I really think incentivizing in those moments is our most powerful play that we can make, because they feel so much emotion. They don't know what's happening. They have all this pent-up energy. And so in their minds, of course, the best way to get it out is to explode, you know, or just to let it out on my mom and dad, because they're safe and they're not going anywhere. And so you become their primary coping strategy in lieu of any others. But they're not going to be internally incentivized to do the work yet, because they get lazy and it's just easier not to. It's easier sometimes for us not to. And so incentivizing, I think, can make a difference. So that's why I wrote the book for adolescent girls, because I think you need another voice saying those things. So really with teenagers, if you can get them to go to counseling, if you can get them to read a book, I would highly recommend that. Or I think you could even say something like, I saw my favorite podcaster interview this woman named Sissy Goff on YouTube. And she talked about this thing about breathing. And I didn't realize it does all these things for your body. And I'm going to start trying it. I thought you might want to try it too, where it's not really like you need to start doing this deep breathing, but it's this My favorite word in parenting adolescents is breezy, to be kind of breezy. And so being breezy about how I think this is going to help me, and it's something maybe you could try too.
And I think, smart.
I think if you can give them a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or something where you can watch what your heart rate does as you deep breathe and they'll get on board. Yeah. I think that can be a great way to teach them, because they're going to be excited about the change.
I love the breezy. I had one friend one time when we first started having kiddos, they had teenagers at the time. And I remember the dad said, listen, you can't focus on the face. When your kids get to be teenagers, you cannot take your cues by the scowl. Okay. They might be saying with their face, this is the dumbest thing you've ever said in your life, but internally they're scared or they're tired or they're weary or they're stressed. And that was great advice. Keep it breezy, mom and dad, because you cannot take your contextual cues from the face. Yeah. That's a really good one.
I love that.
Okay, great. So that's number one. Okay, number two
is a cognitive behavioral therapy technique that we're going to use called grounding tools, because now their body has calmed down enough that they can get out of the loop, but they don't know how. And so we need to do something that requires focus for them. So my favorite one is 5-4-3-2-1. We use all the senses, because any sensory data is grounding for them. Mm. And when I say grounding, I literally mean anxiety resides in the past and the future, not the present. And so we've got to pull them back down to the present moment. And so tell me 5 things you see, tell me 4 things you hear, tell me 3 things you feel, 2 things you smell, 1 thing you taste. And it can be any order. It's just the 5 senses. And with little ones, sometimes I'll say, tell me 3 things you hear, 3 things you see, and wiggle 3 parts of your body, because that helps them get some of the energy out as well. I will have them do math based on their age. Like teenagers, sometimes I'll say, count backwards from 100 by 7s, which is, I'm not sure that I could do that.
No, for very long. I'd have to concentrate.
But yeah, but all those things require focus. If kids are in school, one of the things they can do is ask to go to the bathroom and go run their hands under really cold water, because that's sensory related. I had a girl just this week in my group who told me that her psychiatrist told her to go from really hot to really cold, because that's kind of, you're focused on the sensory piece of it.
Super interesting. So
we want to do some kind of grounding like that to pull them out of the loop. So that's the second. And I think with teenagers, I would say the same thing. I learned this other tool the other day that was really cool, and then go into that. Or let them see you in the car going.
Right.
And then that let them modeling ask you about piece. It.
Yes, exactly. And I love what you say about bringing to the present. At some point in one of the books, you say the anxiety is an, I will butcher this quote, and I'm so sorry to say it to the
author. I won't remember it. So
okay, good. That anxiety is a disordered, anticipation mm-hmm. is really the deal, or looking backward. So it's not present focused, which is kind of hard for us to remember, because it sure looks present. When someone is wigging out, it looks very much present tense. But remembering, oh no, you got to remember to ground your body in this space to remember where you are right this second. Super powerful. Love that. I love that. Okay. Yes. So we have breathing, grounding.
And then the third is talking back to the worry or anxiety. And so with the little kids, we call it the worry monster a lot of times, unless they're afraid of monsters, and then they call it worry bug, or their worry brain, and their smart brain is another way to do it that a lot of psychologists use that I like. Or they can come up with their own name. I often will have kids come up with their own name for it, and they come up with really fun, creative ones. Like, had a girl who named hers Bob. No clue why she picked Bob.
Again, no relation to Bob Goff. Now, can you talk to me about this? Because I think that's super powerful, naming the thing. When I first, you use worry monster as the stand-in in your book. And again, for older kids, that's probably not the right choice. But why is it so important to put a name on this?
Because, you and I both have a voice in our heads that's either telling us things we need to be worried about. It's telling us how we failed, something. And I don't know if you could think back to the first time you realized it wasn't truth. and that it made things bigger than they were. But I think for a lot of us who are adults, we were adults maybe ourselves, if not teenagers. And so if we can teach them younger, that voice always lies to me. It makes me feel bad about myself. And it's trying to make me think I'm not capable of doing certain things. That's not me. And it's not true. You know, it just, it reduces its power to give it a name in that way. And I think, you know, I talk a lot about the worry monster, but I also think if it's a perfectionist voice, it's not going to be, I'm afraid of storms, but it's going to be, I'm going to fail. I'm going to mess up. No one's going to like me if I mess up. And so helping those kids kind of shift and come up with that kind of language around it can be really helpful. So they name it, and we can also then start to recognize it when it shows back up, because as anxiety is connected to temperament, what we see is that kids start off in that kind of whack-a-mole game with being afraid of one thing, and then they get a little bit older and that thing doesn't matter as much. So it morphs to the next thing, and then it morphs to the next thing. And as we're practicing skills, it's going to get smaller as time goes by. But as a parent, if you have a child who used to loop about something bad happening to you and all of a sudden won't get on the airplane to go to spring break, you can say, sounds like Bob's back to me. What worked with him last time? Because let's go back to those very same tools, because they're going to work no matter what. And then eventually we want to teach them to talk back to Bob. Bob, I'm not listening to you. You're always wrong. You're not the boss of me. You don't have any power over me. And then get them to go do something different. But I think, you know, really, if we're as adults in counseling, one of the first things we do is positive self-talk. And that's what we're teaching them really early on. And in the teenage book, I call it the worry whisperer, because that's what it feels like. He's kind of whispering these things that feel true to them. And so they can name it too.
Oh, so that's my
first 3 months of counseling.
Thank you, everyone. Venmo to Sissy Goff, because you just got a full 3 months. Thank you for distilling some of those fantastic tools. I love it that you remind us over and over in your writing that those tools last beyond the moment. So when you say today it's not getting on a plane, tomorrow it's failing the ACT or not being able to go to the college you want, or all of your friends hate you, or you don't have any friends, all of the object of the sentence seems to shift a little bit. But if you have solid tools, that's something that goes with you. And I really think it's important when you point out again and again, for folks who are dealing with this, adults, teens, children, it's not a kindness to say, we're just going to get over this, or we're going to grow out of this, and then we won't have these fears anymore. We won't have fear, or we won't have worry. That is a shift of the prism for me, because some of the things that I've read about anxiety kind of intimates that, well, we're just going to move through this season. But then when you're 25, everything will really make sense. And you make the point, no, not necessarily. I mean, life is scary. Life has lots of things and a lot of obstacles in our way. So learning these things, learning the way to move through that is something to go through every season.
Right. Because I'm never going to stop being a perfectionist. It's just woven into the fabric of who I am. It can have less power. I can live with less fear. But when I am really sad about something, my house is going to be so organized, probably till I die. You know, it's just it's just who I am.
How is that? So that makes me think that maybe there's a superpower there. Is there a superpower for kids and teens with anxiety? I mean, you mentioned perfectionism. There's a superpower in perfectionism. I want my surgeon to be a perfectionist, please.
Yes.
Right? I want my international pilot of a plane, please be a perfectionist. Please don't be I don't know, we'll see what happens. So what are the superpowers for kids who have anxiety?
They're thoughtful. They're intelligent. One really interesting thing that I am noticing more and more, even in the last few months, which doesn't mean it's new, it just means I'm maybe starting to notice it, but I'm finding that kids who are really, girls particularly, who are really intuitive, often end up being anxious, because I think, you know, research says, I read this a million years ago and I'm so attached to it, that when something goes wrong in a boy's world, he most often blames someone else. And when something goes wrong in a girl's world, she most often blames herself. Whatever age we are, I think, I'm sure men learn to work through it in a different way, but I think we continue that. And so in light of that, I am sitting with so many girls who pick up on the fact that their friend is not very kind, or their friend is not that responsive and maybe even has some social skill issues or something like that. But rather than thinking, my friend's got something going on, they think, oh no, what did I do? I hurt her feelings. Instead of, you know, either she just struggles socially, or even she got in a fight with her mom that morning. Right. And so she's just not smiling at school, but they tend to make it about them. But intuitively, I think they're super intuitive. So they're picking up on something in their environment. They're just shifting it into an attack on themselves. Mm. So I think intuition would be one as well.
Yeah. Gift gone awry. Sissy Goff, I can't even handle how much I appreciate your work and your wisdom and the care and compassion that you use to go about these things. I mean, I really gather from you, this is not just your work, it's your calling, and you want health and vibrancy and joy coming in and out of that little yellow house. And so thank you for sharing that in written form. For folks who are listening, if you have not started to follow and read everything Sissy Goff says, I'm not even joking. Just follow her. Be like her little Havanese puppy, Lucy. Follow her around. Listen to her. Definitely pre-order in July. But thank you. Thank you for helping parents on this roller coaster and helping teenagers and kids all figure out how to live lives full and abundant. It's just, I can't imagine a time when your work has been more needed. So thank you.
Well, thank you for being a delightful light in this world and speaking a lot of truth to parents in a hilarious, gracious way. So I'm so glad to know you and glad we're friends.
You are so kind. I have one last indulgent question for you before you go. It's okay. A totally personal question that's not invasive.
Okay.
I ask all of my guests two questions about books. I'm a book nerd.
Great.
I'm looking at your situation right there. You have a few books behind you. You've read 8,000 books about anxiety. So it's a two-parter. What is a book that you recommend over and over? And this could be within your field of interest. It could be a novel. It could be anything you want. Something that you return to over and over, a book that you've loved for years. And then second part of that question, is there a book on your bookshelf or on your nightstand that you're really excited about reading and have not yet?
I would say, I love those questions. Those are really neat questions. I think the first answer would be, because I love it and because there are so many lines that are truth, but it's not like a book I recommend in counseling, but I think it's my favorite book. Is my favorite author is Frederick Buechner. And the book called A Room Called Remember, I think is my favorite. So far, I haven't read all of his. I've read most of them, but that is my very favorite.
Okay. Wonderful recommendation.
He's a good one. Mm-hmm. Well, I love him. And then a book. So I am terrible about reading novels. And I want to read. I've gotten to where I'm just watching a lot of shows rather than reading novels. And I want to switch back. And so, but one of my favorite authors is a woman that wrote, I think, pre and around World War II, named Elizabeth Googe. G-O-U-D-G-E.
Okay.
And I have a book of hers that I'm excited to read called The Scent of Water, which I wouldn't recommend it yet because I haven't read it. I have a feeling it'll be great. But she has some books. What are they called? They're probably on my shelf close to me. I can't think of the names of them.
No worries. We'll link to these. I will Google and link.
Here they are. I see them. A Bird in the Tree is the first of, there's a series of three that I love. So
how about that? I've awesome. Never heard her name in my whole stinking life. Googe.
Well, she's hard to find. G-O-U-D-G-E. A lot of them aren't even in print, but she is so thoughtful and there's a lot of hope and humor and she's a believer, but it's very, I mean, yeah, it's just awesome. They're awesome.
Oh, I just love that. I'm popping that to the top of the list. I love a new author.
Well, tell me, you'll have to let me know what you think.
I totally will. Sissy Goff, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Mm-hmm. I just so appreciate your time. We are in desperate need of you. So thank you for listening to my persistent begging and being so gracious about it and not being frightened of me. Thank you. Thanks for being on.
Kimberly, I'm so glad to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, what a masterclass. I hope you feel encouraged and hopeful and also equipped to love the people in your world, especially those wrestling with anxiety. You are not alone. Your kids are not alone. And there is so much hope. Thank you for trusting me with your time. I don't take lightly the gift it is to hang out with you, so thank you. As always, please share this episode with someone who came to mind while you were listening. And if you have a second, pretty please leave a quick review of For Real on your podcast app. Reviews are huge to us. Thank you for helping us spread the word. That's all for today, but we will be back soon with more conversations to inspire and lift up and encourage you on your stretch of road. For real.